9 minutes after eight. Good morning. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network this week. Well, here are a couple of questions for you. Why do so many of us make bad choices on important issues like health, finances, education, and climate change? When it comes to borrowing money, for example, why are we more like Homer Simpson than Ben Franklin? Why is that? Do we really want to make bad choices? Very few of us can pass the age of 50 with no regrets about choices, so why do we make all these bad decisions? Well, that's what we're going to try and find out this hour. My guest this hour is Richard H. Thaler, a pioneer in the fields of behavioral economics and finance. He is currently the Ralph and Dorothy Keller Distinguished Services Professor of Behavioral Science and Economics and Director of the Center for Decision Research at the Graduate School of Business at the University of Chicago. He is also the co-author with Cass R. Sunstein of Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness, published by Yale University Press. Good morning, Professor, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, how do you fit all those titles onto a business card, or don't you? Very small print.
I just say prof.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll remember that because I was running out of breath before the end there. What is behavioral economics?
Well, behavioral economics is really it's just economics with humans instead of what in the book we call econs. Economists have come to define economic agents as pretty strange beings. They are as smart as Einstein, and they have the self-control of Mahatma Gandhi. And the rest of us have trouble calculating the tax on or the tip at a restaurant and realize after we've done eating that we ordered at least one dish too many. So what behavioral economists have tried to do is build up economic models with real people as the agents rather than the imaginary creatures that populate economics textbooks.
That sounds rather close to heresy.
Yeah, some people have accused me of worse.
Okay. Was there some sort of aha moment that led to the creation of this particular book? And if so, what was it?
Well, this particular book, you know, we use the phrase libertarian paternalism to describe what we're up to. And the origin of that phrase came when I was giving a talk at the University of Chicago, my home institution, and there's nothing really, no insult deeper than to be called a paternalist. And maybe communist would be worse, but I'm not sure. So I was giving a talk on something maybe we'll talk about later, save more tomorrow. And a colleague of mine was the discussant, and he said, well, gee, isn't that paternalism? You know, and I could feel the knives going into me. And I said, well, yes, it's paternalism, but it's, well, I get, there's no coercion here. Maybe it's libertarian paternalism. And thus the phrase was born. And 5 years later, that phrase had turned into a book.
You talk about the power of nudging. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, let me give an example that we use to motivate the book. Suppose that the director of a school cafeteria discovers through experimentation that the order in which the food is displayed influences the choices that people make, that the kids make. That the stuff you put at the beginning of the line or the end of the line or at eye level is more likely to be chosen. What use should she make of this with this information? Well, one choice she could make is to put the foods that are healthier in the places where they're more likely to be picked. That's what we call a nudge. It doesn't take choices away from any of the kids, but it makes it at least somewhat more likely that they'll take the apples over the Twinkies. And So that's what we mean by that big awkward, awful phrase, libertarian paternalism. And nudge, I think everyone agrees, is a little friendlier and easier to remember. And so we're suggesting that many people can nudge others to better choices without restricting their choices, and that's what the book is really about.
Well, let's talk about some examples of where we can use a nudge in our lives, and who should be giving us that nudge.
Well, the people that offer the nudges, in the book we refer to them as choice architects, and we're all choice architects in our own domains. But a choice architect can be the person that writes a menu in a restaurant and decides what order to put the various dishes and what to call them. A choice architect can be a real architect is a choice architect too. If you design a building, where you put the restrooms influences which people you get to see on your walk from your office down to the restroom. Where you put the elevators, if they're sort of hidden away, maybe people are more likely to take the stairs. So we're all choice architects, and what our book really has two goals. One is to alert people to the fact that choice architecture matters, and second, to urge the people who are choice architects to nudge for good.
The influencing the thinking of Americans is nothing new. Madison Avenue has been doing it for years. The government does it. Politicians do it. You're talking about guiding people to better choices while at the same time preserving their individual rights to make those choices. When I was reading this, that just jumped out at me as being something of a paradox. How do we resolve this? We want to get people to make better choices, but we still want to give them a lot of choices. Those two things seem to work against each other.
Well, that's many people's initial reaction, that these two things are impossible to reconcile, but they're not really. So consider the government's fairly recent Medicare prescription drug program. I'm sure many of your listeners have had to deal with that program, either for themselves if they're over 65 or perhaps for a parent or grandparent who's had to deal with this program. And this is I would nominate as the single worst bit of choice architecture ever devised by anybody. And the thing they emphasized was maximizing choices. So participants have to choose, get to choose, let's say, let's put it in a positive spin, get to choose from about 50 different insurance plans that vary from state to state. So the lots of choices part they nailed. But the guiding people toward good choices part they flunked. They make it very difficult to choose among those plans. There's a website that's very badly designed, and it would be very easy to guess which of the insurance plans would be best for an individual based on the drugs they're taking in the past year. The older you get, the more drugs you end up taking, and many of those drugs you take forever. So for a typical 80-year-old, it's a real good guess that the drugs they're taking now are the ones they're going to take next year. So the government would have a very easy time of predicting what drugs you're going to take and which plan offers the lowest prices, but they make no effort to help you figure that out.
As someone with a senior parent, I really resonate to that, because the array of choices in that plan were just bewildering. I mean, some people just threw up their hands, and of course there were great penalties for not making a choice.
Well, that's right. And, you know, one of the big themes in our book is the importance of what are called default options. A default option is simply what happens if you do nothing. And normally what happens if you do nothing is nothing happens. But in some situations, if you do nothing, something happens. So, for example, on your computer, if you do nothing long enough, the screensaver comes on. If you do nothing long enough, maybe the screen locks itself. How long those things happen, well, there was a default option for that, and most people never get around to changing those. And the research shows that whatever you pick as the default option, people are very likely to choose. And default options is one of the most powerful ways to nudge people. So if you do a good job of picking default options, you can do a very good job of guiding choices without restricting choices. So you're allowed to put any screensaver you want on your computer, but they've built one in for those of us who never get around to putting a picture of their grandchildren on their screensaver. And that's a good thing because you want some screensaver so you don't burn your screen to death.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk some more about nudges, and we'll take some phone calls from our listeners. What areas could you use a nudge in? Talk maybe about how you reach what your decision process is. How do you make decisions about important things in your life, and what kinds of help do you think you could use to make those decisions, to make good ones? Maybe talk about some bad decisions that you've made and what you learned from that, and if you learned your lesson and didn't make that decision over again. Give us a call and join us as we discuss this topic. Here are your phone numbers, 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. 800-642-1234, toll-free. In Madison, it's a local call for you, so please use 263-1890, 263-1890. You can also reach us on the internet, talk@wpr.org. You see, even here at Wisconsin Public Radio, we're offering you a whole bunch of choices. Choices, choices everywhere. They surround us. Well, we'll talk about that. Stay tuned. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's about 23 minutes after 8 o'clock on this Monday morning. Here's what's coming up later on the Ideas Network. Avoiding eggs to control cholesterol, 8 glasses of water a day, cancer-causing cell phones. After 5, Ben Marin's guest physician discusses medical myths. Medical myths after 5 o'clock. Today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour we're talking about how to improve your decisions and your life. My guest by phone is Richard Thaler, who is one of the co-authors of the book Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness, published by Yale University Press. 800-642-1234 and 263-1890 are the phone numbers you can use to reach the program and ask a question of the professor about the book or the topic at hand. We're talking about how we make decisions. Well, let's go to that. What's the process that most of us use to make these decisions? And we have to make important ones all the time. What to wear in the morning, whether to buy this car or that car, whether to buy that brand of cat food or this other brand, whatever it is, we seem to be confronted in this society, at any rate, with a bewildering array of choices and temptations, and we have to make a lot of decisions about our financial future and so forth. Do we have a model for the process that the average person uses to make those kinds of decisions, and if so, what is it?
Well, I don't think we have a single model, but one of the most powerful things people do is what in the book we cheekily call the "yeah, whatever" heuristic. And the idea is that people just often throw up their hands and go with the flow. And when we're watching TV, when we're done with one show and another one comes on, we act like switching the remote is a very costly activity. In many domains, we just go with whatever we've been doing in the past and never bother to fix it. In people's 401k plans, we've discovered that many people have the same asset allocation the day they retire as the day they started work. The same allocation of money going in. The amount of money they have in various funds will vary greatly depending on the returns on those things. But people are just not paying very much attention to many of the aspects of their life. And then when they get into the occasional decision that really requires some careful thought and number crunching, many people are just ill-equipped for it. And much of the subprime crisis is an illustration of exactly that. Picking a mortgage is really hard. Many of my finance professor colleagues, including me, don't feel very confident that we would pick the best one. And, you know, if we can't do it, what's the typical person expected to do?
Let's take the retirement issue as an example. How could a nudge there help us?
Well, let's go back to the idea I mentioned earlier in the show of something a colleague and I developed that we call Save More Tomorrow. And the idea is that if you ask people in 401k plans, do you think you're saving enough? Most people say no. About two-thirds of the participants say, well, really, I should be saving more. And then if you ask them, well, are you going to do anything about that? They say, yes, yes. Next year, I'm going to increase the proportion I'm saving. And then, of course, if we check next year, they don't get around to it. So based on all of that, we devised this program where companies offer their employees the option of joining a plan where they commit themselves to increasing the proportion of their income that goes into the retirement plan starting next year, and in particular, when they get a raise. And this is based on lots of psychology. One is that we all have more self-control for the future. Many of us are planning diets, but not tonight or not this weekend, maybe next month. And so if we offer the people to start saving in a few months when they get a raise, they find that very attractive. And by linking it to the raise, we avoid something that we call loss aversion. People are very sensitive to their income going down. But when they get a raise, if they're asked to put, say, a third of that raise toward the retirement plan, they say, oh, yeah, I can do that. And in the first company where we adopted this, we tripled saving rates. And the plan is now available in thousands of employers all over the country. And if your employer doesn't offer it, bug them, and maybe they will.
You mentioned putting off a diet, and I recognized all of those, particularly the I'm going on a diet right after the fill-in-the-blank holidays.
Right.
So how would the nudge idea work there? Who would be giving me that nudge, and how would they do it?
Well, I mean, you can give yourself the nudge there. So if you say, okay, I'm going to go on a diet starting right after the 4th of July, well, do something about it. So join Weight Watchers. Buy 6 weeks of meals from one of these companies that sends you the food. And if you think about the psychology of why one of those plans works, it's not like there's some magic in the food they send you, but the portions are limited. And so if you committed yourself in advance and then spent the money, that can help. Now you've got 6 weeks of food in the freezer, and people hate to waste. So if they started eating that food and that food exclusively, they're bound to lose weight.
My experience has been that most of us have no idea why we eat what we eat. I ate a stale donut this morning that had been out here in the lobby of Wisconsin Public Radio Central since Saturday afternoon. It was dry. I ate it anyway. Have no idea why.
Yeah, well, I can tell you why, because it was there. And the best way to avoid those things is not to see them.
So I ate the donut for the same reason that Hillary climbed climbed Mount Everest, because it was
there?
Well,
that's right. Well, you know, it took him a little bit more work.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't ascribe my lofty motives to my donut consumption, but I identify way more with Homer Simpson than I do with any
heroes.
Yeah,
well, the unfortunate thing is we all do.
Yeah. Well, let me give a nudge to our callers. What kinds of bad economic decisions have you made, or maybe some good ones? And where do you think you could use a little help, and where would you like it to come from, and can you give yourself a nudge? Here's a number. I'll give you a couple of choices of how to reach us, in fact. 800-642-1234, that's the toll-free number, 800-642-1234, toll-free. In Madison, you can make that a local call, and that's 263-1890, 263-1890. You can also reach us via the Internet. We have an email address. It's talk@WPR.org. We're talking about nudges, and we're talking about making choices how we make choices and what that maybe says about us. So you talk a lot in the book about the bad decisions people make, about what kind of mortgage to get, about their health insurance, about things like our diet, about how we invest our money or whether we invest our money. Every phase of our life we have all these choices, and we seem to be going wrong. We're, as a country, we're obese. We spend more money than we take in. We don't save as much as we borrow. We're in a heap of trouble. I want to go back to a point that we alluded to a little bit earlier, but I didn't follow up. You talk about these choice architects, and let me back up the truck here a second. If we're kind of dumb on our own, I think it was Terry Pratchett who wrote that individuals are smart, mobs are stupid. But if we're kind of dumb about making these choices, who is it then? Who are these choice architects who are smart enough to nudge us in the right way, and why should we believe them?
Well, so the first answer is we shouldn't always believe them, and so it's a truism that everyone is nudging us. So the shady mortgage brokers that were going door to door selling mortgages that they knew people couldn't afford a year from now were nudgers and choice architects, and you can use the tricks in our book for good or evil. There's no doubt about that. Now, then what's the role of government? We think that the role of government is to make it as easy as possible for we Homer Simpsons to stumble toward good choices. So, and we talk about lots of ways to make that easier. One of the ideas that we're pushing is something called electronic disclosure, and it sounds complicated, but I think it would actually be quite simple. The idea is that in lots of domains, but let me just illustrate it with credit cards. Credit cards used to be simple. You'd apply for a credit card and it would be easy. The credit card companies, as you're kind of suggesting, have devised lots of ways to make money off of you. And some of the ways they do it are buried in the fine print. And it's very difficult to figure out what those are. What we're suggesting is that the government require your credit card company to send you each year two electronic files. They would be essentially spreadsheets. One would be a list of all the ways that they can charge you for things. So if you make a trip up to Canada and they charge you 3% for transferring your Canadian dollars into American dollars, that's in there. If you miss a payment and they charge you a penalty and raise your interest rate, that's in there. The second electronic file is simply a list of all the things you did last year that incurred charges. Now, it's not that we think that anybody would look at those files, although maybe a few geeks would. What we think is that third parties would quickly emerge that would open up websites where you could upload those files, and the website would serve two functions. One would be a translation function. and they would say, well, here's the way your credit card company is screwing you. And it's pretty sly, but this is what they're doing. And if you plan to use a credit card the same way next year, here are three other credit card issuers that it seems like are offering you a better deal, and here's why. Now, should you trust that guy? And the answer is, well, there'd be competition in that domain to be honest brokers. And we think that there are certain kinds of companies that have established themselves as good, honest brokers and are likely to emerge as the winners. Two examples might be, one might be Google. I think they've been pretty scrupulous in presenting the searches in a way that doesn't favor somebody. And if people pay for ads, those are labeled as ads. And another might be Morningstar, the mutual fund rating company. And in fact, the way these third-party websites would work is much like what Morningstar does, or and to some extent the travel websites would be another way. So it's not that we think that President Obama or President McCain should be deciding things for us. What we think is that they should be hiring experts to devise rules that will make it easier for us to make good choices and creating environments where we're more likely to make good choices.
So no nudger in chief. Let's take a call from Diane in Madison. Diane, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Back in the 60s, we had a friend who was an ad man, and he absolutely forbade his children to watch the ads on kids' TV because he knew how powerful those ads are to just wash the kids forward into the ad man's nudge. And advertisements have been driving American choices for a very long time, for good or ill, whatever. And I think your guest book is letting us see behind the advertising Oz curtain. But the ad men have always kept one step ahead of us, so now they're going to have to keep one step ahead of the book. And I thank them for the book.
And thank you for the call, Diane.
Okay.
So Madison Avenue, well, that's certainly where we get a lot of nudges, and sometimes the nudges are conflicting.
Well, that's right, and it is, as Diane suggested, Madison Avenue certainly understands this, and we can't close our eyes and pretend that they don't exist. And so the electronic disclosure idea that I was just talking about is in some ways an antidote to that. We think, just to expand on that point a little bit further, we think that the idea of plain English disclosure has become obsolete. Never mind mortgages. Most of us don't understand our cell phone plans. And, you know, think about when our parents were ordering a phone, there were no choices. The phone was black. And there were two prices. There was the monthly charge, and then there were long-distance fees. It was pretty easy. Well, and there was one supplier. So life was pretty easy. It wasn't good, but it was easy. You know, when we're choosing cell phone plans, each company's got a whole array of choices, and comparing among those is frighteningly complex. And I think we need a little help, and this electronic disclosure idea would allow us to search among all those plans and to get somebody to help us, and to get the somebody to help us would be an independent third party.
Let's go to line one and take a call from Heidi. Heidi in Manitowoc. Good morning.
Good morning. I had a comment. Your guest mentioned that we can get nudges from other resources, or we can set up nudges for ourselves. And as far as the mortgage goes, my husband and I set up a 20-year mortgage for ourselves instead of a 30-year, and we'll save $40,000 just by paying less than $100 a month more each month for our mortgage.
I think that's a great idea. And, you know, what's true is that in our parents' generation, there was a very strong norm that people paid off their mortgages by the time they retired. And that norm has completely broken down. Now, I'm 62, and people my age have mortgages, and with no plan in any near future of paying them off.
Well, isn't part of the reason for that that you bought or built a house shortly after you got married? You lived in it all your life, and you paid it off, and that's where you stayed. You probably worked at one job your whole life, and the average person, I mean, that was the American ideal. You find this job at some point when you're in your early 20s, and you raise your family in a community. You stay in the same house. It's the Cleavers.
Well, I think the Cleavers, I mean, that the story you're telling is partly true, although the Cleavers was a bit of a myth. People did move, even in the 50s. But when they would move, they would take the money they had saved up in the first house and use that toward the second one, and it was always with the goal of paying down the mortgage. And if there was some windfall, that would often go, the first goal was to pay off the mortgage. And I think that the suggestion that people take mortgages with shorter terms is an excellent one. And it's just a little self-control device. We pay off the mortgage without thinking about it. And so if you can possibly afford a 20-year mortgage or a 15-year mortgage, that's going to be a very good way of assuring that when you reach retirement, you'll have one less thing to worry about.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we have some more callers who want to join us on this topic. We're talking about a book, a brand-new book just published by Yale University Press called Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness. And we have Richard Thaler, who's one of the authors of that book, on to talk about this. And you can join us as well at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. In Madison, it's 263-1890, 263-1890. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 844. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week. After 9, Kathleen Dunn will be in, and her guest after 9 is New York Times columnist Frank Rick. They'll be talking politics after 9 here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about our choices and how we might be nudged into making healthier or wiser ones. And we have full phone banks, and so we'll go to the phones and take a call first from James in Galena, Illinois. James, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks
for joining us.
Good morning. I'm interested in your guest book. I haven't picked it up yet, but I probably will. I'm 72 years old, and I was a directing business agent with the Machinist Union for over 30 years. And some of the things that your guest is proposing are pretty good. However, until we change the tax laws, out of the 38 plants that I serviced in three states, there's only 34 of them left. Some of them went to Mexico, some of them to China, and some of them went bankrupt. And those that went bankrupt, the individual employees and those companies lost the money that they had in their savings accounts because it was sort of like an Enron deal. Some of those accounts you can't draw your money out until you're at least 60, and they freeze you in, the law needs to be changed in that manner, to which the pension plans or the savings account on a bankruptcy deal, you pay the employees or those individuals for their wages in their savings account first. The second point I would make is if we changed our tax laws on our savings accounts, for example, tax your money before you put it into a savings account, into a bank, but the first $25,000 in interest money you make is tax-free instead of taxable, you'd see a lot more employees, and that money would be guaranteed by the federal government, up to $100,000 of it in each bank. You would see this country go to a savings account much, much quicker than what they are now. But the tax laws need to be changed.
Professor, does that sound like the kind of nudge we could use?
Well, we could have a debate about that. I guess on the first point that the caller made, which is making sure that companies don't run off with the people's investments, I completely agree. I think actually many of those laws are in place, but the ones that aren't should be tightened. And one thing that we should certainly clamp down on is companies encouraging or even requiring their employees to invest in company stock. And we should have learned the lesson from Enron that it's really not a good idea for employees to have most of their 401k money invested in the company they work for, because otherwise they can wake up one morning and be out of a job and out of a retirement fund at the same time. And I think we have to put a stop to that. As to whether savings are tax-favored, I think the evidence on that suggests that the tax treatment of the interest is probably less important than creating simple ways for people to save. And so a 401k plan has two features. One is the saving is tax-sheltered, and the second is that it's withdrawn from your paycheck automatically and you can't touch it. And the caller suggested that that was a bad feature. I'd say that was a good feature. And the reason is that it's like a piggy bank. And right now we have a zero saving rate in this country, and it's because people have self-control problems. And creating more piggy banks is probably a good idea.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to John in Milwaukee. John, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Hi. An interesting one that I saw on the internet that the state of Wisconsin provides is for shopping for medical care. I mean, everybody talks about how we should be better shoppers and we want a free market medical system, but there's no real way to shop. When you get sick, you just want to get better. But what Wisconsin was offering, or what I had seen on the internet, is a bill take a look at a particular procedure, a standard procedure like, say, a pregnancy or something, and it will allow you to look at the average price of all the pregnancies in a particular county in Wisconsin, and then you can actually zero down to the hospital level, and it'll show you what the average price per hospital was. So it allows you to do shopping for medical care, and I thought it was a great, great, great website, and that more people should be made aware of it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And this idea that I've been pushing this morning about electronic disclosure, really the underlying theme is that if we require suppliers in lots of different domains to reveal their prices in electronic forms, then the kind of website you're talking about can emerge. So the reason why a company like Morningstar exists, And that's a good place to get information about mutual funds, is because the government requires mutual funds to disclose their holdings once a quarter. There's no website where you can look and get information about hedge funds, because hedge funds are required to make that kind of disclosure. So the lesson here is that if we want those kinds of helpful websites, then the simplest thing to do is to require the providers to give us the information in a way that these websites can emerge.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or 263-1890, the numbers to call to join our program this morning. We'll go next to Marion in New Berlin. Marion, good morning.
Good morning. How are you? Hello?
Hello. Yeah,
pretty good. Go ahead.
You had asked people's plans or approaches for decision-making. I tend to be the kind of person who needs to look at the broad picture first, so my plan is usually to look to see if I can find any general guidelines for decision-making. For example, if I'm going to buy a car, you know, look to see like a consumer's report analysis of the various cars. Or when I was looking for drug insurance, I went to the Social Security website that, you know, helped point out which was the best plan for me. And then once I do that, I move to a more narrow approach, look at what information I have found from these various larger sources, and then try to match those up with what I think my needs are, and then make the decision on that basis. For example, some years ago when my husband and I were planning a cruise to Alaska, got all kinds of travel books to look to see what was available and then look to see what matched what my interests were. So I think I use a kind of a broad to a narrow plan when I do my decision making.
Well, you know, I think that all sounds great, and I think if everyone were like you, the world wouldn't need as much help.
You wouldn't have anybody to sell your book to either.
Essentially, the proposals that we make in the book are, at one level, to make it easier for people like you to do what you're doing in a more comprehensive way, and then probably more important, to help those of us who don't have the patience or time or inclination to do such a thorough search, to allow us to approximate your detailed research in a quick and dirty way.
Very helpful. If more people become aware of that kind of resource, I think that helps out a lot.
Right.
Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Marion, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Pete in Bellevue, Iowa. Pete, good morning.
Good morning to you guys. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good.
Great. I've had paid my house off already at the age of about 50. It's a modest ranch home. But as I look at advice I get constantly from money managers and CPAs and things like that, you constantly hear this idea that, oh, that could have been a mistake. You shouldn't have paid that house off. You should be investing in the market instead. You could have been writing off the interest or whatever on the house. And it gets so complicated to the point where I think the average person feels pulled by these financial systems that it clouds the issue as to what should be happening in a person's life financially, especially if you have children or going to college and things like that. So I guess my question is, you know, how does and your book probably mainly addresses that. How does a person kind of cut through this this financial jargon that is out there to pull people into systems that gets over their head, basically, to even understand what to do? It's almost like, gosh, I wish I would have done a CD at 4% for 5 years and forgot all these losses in the market, because that's where they've been, you know, encouraging me to deliver my money to now.
Right. You know, I think that you make a very good point, and let me just respond in the following way, that I think that the advice that you have to give somebody depends on their personality. So, you know, here you've paid off your mortgage at 50. I'm a little less worried about your ability to save than somebody who's just taken out a new mortgage with 5% down at 55. So, yes, it's true that your mortgage interest is deductible, and you can make an argument that you'd be better off borrowing $100,000 on your house, you'd borrow that tax-free and invest it, and if if you make more on the investment than the after-tax interest rate, you're ahead. I think there's a certain truth to that.
Well, that's what people who were selling these Option R mortgages were telling people. Listen, take the equity in your house and invest it at 10% a year, and your interest rate is less than that, and your home is going to keep increasing in value, and so you can put all these things, all these interest payments off, and you'll just make a ton of money. And, of course, that didn't turn out to be
true. Right. So, you know, I think what's true is you're not going to make a ton of money, and you're certainly taking on a lot of risk that most people are not really able to appreciate. And there's a lot to be said for sort of taking the view, I'm not in here to make every possible penny. And if I take a more conservative approach and say, all right, I'm going to make sure I pay off my house, and then I'm going to take the rest of my investments and put them in index funds, which have low fees, and give up any chance of beating the market, but also make sure I don't lose to the market. These are all strategies that aren't going to make you rich, but are going to make sure you're not poor.
Well, my current plan is the work till I die plan.
That's a can I recommend an occasional golf game or?
Well, you see, here's another thing. You read golf magazines, and every month they give you the opposite advice from the previous month about how to fix your game.
Yeah, well, that's so, how to sell golf magazines.
Well, I canceled my subscription because the choices were bewildering. But I don't mean to make light of it, but that happens a lot. We get one month you see someone on a business channel saying, you know, don't pay off your credit cards. That's bad for your credit. And the next time you see somebody, they're saying, go ahead and pay them off. And there seemingly are a bewildering array of choices. We don't have time to go into too much more of that, but you certainly have given us a lot of food for thought in this hour, Professor, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Richard Thaler is a pioneer in the field of behavioral economics, and he's one of the co-authors of the book with Cass Sunstein of Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness, published by Yale University Press. This program was produced by Carmen Jackson with on-air production by Cynthia Schuster and Rob Ferret. Stay tuned for Kathleen Dunn coming up after the news. In the meantime, have a great day. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine all this week here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.